by how to count one photon and get a result of 1,000. Before I do that, I want to give thanks to the people who actually did most of the work I'll be telling you about today. So this is a list of the folks currently in my group and a number of people who've been instrumental in the past. One of these guys is in the audience somewhere, but I lost the name. The work I'm going to tell you about today is principally due to Martin Halaji, Greg Mohovsky, and Amir Fezpour, taken over more recently by Josiah Sinclair. And as I said, I want to begin with a few reminders. I'm going to go through these things rather briefly since most of the audience is familiar with them. In the meantime, I forgot to put this thing on. And I want to do that by motivating the idea of discussing conditional measurements. So again, just in two or three slides, I want to talk about why I think we should be interested in conditional measurements and how the weak value approach to conditional measurements is connected to certain other quantities that I think are of interest. And I'll show one or two old examples from work in my own group to motivate what I think some open questions are, why it's reasonable to suspect that this particular approach might be trying to tell us something else about reality, help us develop a better intuition, as Yerkeo would say, for thinking about quantum mechanics. So I'll talk about momentum transfer in Verhoeven experiments. I'll talk about some new questions that one can address thanks to weak measurement, such as a version of Heisenberg precision disturbance relations. And then I'll get into the meat of our more recent experiment, when is one photon worth more than one photon, like this Matryoshka up here, in particular amplifying the effect of a single photon. And I'll talk a bit about how this is in the fully quantum regime, the first time that an optical weak value amplification experiment has had no classical explanation. I'll get up to that. And if I haven't run out of time, I'll tell you about what we haven't completed yet. I've been talking about it for 20 years, but now I'm no longer embarrassed because we're close to being able to do the experiments. So here's the question. Can we tell what goes on behind closed doors in quantum mechanics? Can we talk about what a photon was doing before we observe it? So here's the example that I always like using. And again, to most of you, this is old hat. But for someone who hasn't wondered why we need to supplement quantum mechanics with any other view of measurement, I think these three box problems are a useful way of thinking about it. And this is a simple variant of the one that some of you have heard about. Suppose that I'm standing on a street corner trying to cheat local tourists out of their money by hiding a $20 bill under one of three boxes. And I'm going to shuffle them around and see if they can guess where the bill is. But being a quantum mechanic, I'm not going to put it under one box or another. I'm going to be more clever and put it in a superposition. So I'll put the bill in a superposition of box A plus box B over root 2. Now, I'm a fair-minded guy, so I'm not going to ask you to guess which box it's in. I know you'd only have a 50% chance. So I'm going to give you some extra information. I'm going to promise that at the end of the day, I will find that $20 bill in a different superposition, box B plus C over root 2. And the job of the foolhardy tourist is to guess where that bill is between my preparation and my post-election. Now, in this audience, I'm scared to even ask the question, so I'll just cut to the chase and tell you what happens when I ask in human audiences. If the human audience is composed of physicists, they all scratch their heads and they're pretty silent. Maybe one person yells out an answer because he already knows about weak measurement. If it's a general lay audience who's heard a few words about quantum mechanics, then with no hesitation whatsoever, they say, whoops, it must be in box B. Because to normal people, if they've heard a little about quantum mechanics, this A plus B means A or B, or something like A or B, and B plus C means something like B or C. And if I know it's in A or B, and I know it's in B or C, I know it's in B, right? Anyone who has not suffered a course in quantum mechanics, as John Bell would have said, knows the answer to this. So to me, the fact that we hesitate proves that there's something that we don't understand well enough, because there is a well-defined and operational sense in which you can say that the probability to be in B was 100%. Right, so that's why I think it's important to think about these conditional measurements. And I just want to argue that there's an unfamiliar approach to thinking about weak value that I still find stimulating. And it's just to begin with Bayes' rule, just to ask, how would you define a conditional expectation value? How would I ask what the expectation value of A is, given that I prepare a system in some state I and find it in some final state F? Well, I could take the weighted average of the eigenvalues, but now by a conditional probability. And the conditional probability can be defined by Bayes' rule. I have to figure out how to generalize that to the quantum setting. So one has to figure out what it means to calculate a probability. That's just the expectation value of a projection operator. That's simple enough. one also has to define what one means by these joint probabilities. And that's a little trickier if A and B aren't Hermitian. So one has to make an assumption here that is well justified but also leads to some issues. But if you trust that assumption, you can go through a few lines of math that I won't lead you through. And you get this interesting expression that looks similar to but different from an expectation value and has a lot of beautiful other mathematical properties. And from this perspective, let me just say that the fact that it comes out of basic axioms of probability theory, suppressing one or two that we have trouble with in this setting, means that it satisfies lots of other rules of probability and linearity and chain rules and things that you might like. So it has a lot of very sweet mathematical properties. But let's move on to something more operational. Let's ask what it would mean to measure the value of some observable conditioned on a post-selection. Now, we know that if we do a really strong measurement, we disturb the system. So asking about the later evolution becomes sort of taboo. Therefore, let us jump into this idea of weak measurement, where, roughly speaking, you can imagine that as we measure some observable on this wave function, we let it interact with a pointer that has such a large initial uncertainty that we're going to get very little information on any individual trial about the thing that we're observing. So it's in that sense that you might say that it should have a small disturbance. Mathematically, what you should really say is that the conjugate variable to that pointer position, the pointer momentum, can be very, very certain. And if you look at the form of the von Neumann Hamiltonian, it's that certainty that now takes away the measurement back action. But those are mathematical details. Let's imagine some interaction and then say, well, since I haven't disturbed the particle, I'm free to ask another question. I'm free to ask what box I find the bill in now. Let me just do a projection and ask whether I find it in this green state that I like or this red lobe that's left over. And only if I find it in the desired green state do I look at the pointer, which then collapses to one position or another. And I get very little information from that pointer. But as in every other measurement, I can average over millions or billions of trials. And as I do this over and over again, keeping all the pointers that I get when the post-selection succeeds, I build up a collection of final pointer positions and a histogram. And when I ask what was the average value of the measurement conditioned on the post-selection, I ask, where is the center of mass of that histogram, or where is the peak of that histogram? And that is what Aharonov, Albert, and Weidman famously derived in this AAV formula, which is exactly the same formula that we saw just from this completely made up, pulled out of a hat, Bayesian argument a moment ago. All right.
Could I ask a question?
Yes.
Are you using, in the back of your mind, 1,000-photon replicas, so do you really have 1,000 photons, or are you somehow spurring that?
By photon now, you mean this system that I'm studying here.
Yeah.
So I'm talking right now about measurements of an ensemble. That's right. So repeated measurements on identically prepared systems.
So it's not really one photon, it's 1,000 photons.
Right now, it's not really one photon, exactly right. And you can discuss with Yakir and the others how to get around that. But I'm avoiding that question for now. I'm imagining an ensemble, as we always do in quantum mechanics, when we measure normal expectation values, of course. I'll just say it also has deep connections to things like Bohmian mechanics. If you try to describe the value of some variable other than position in Bohmian mechanics, it turns out the natural way to describe it is mathematically equivalent, as any naive experimentalist with no knowledge of quantum mechanics would realize, to this weak value approach. There are many other examples. And in partial reference to Marlin's question, I'll say that many people say, that's not what a measurement is. I've read my quantum mechanics textbooks. That's not what they tell me to do. In fact, just a week or two ago, someone said, oh, but you don't get one precise result that's then exactly repeatable, so this isn't a measurement. And to me, that just means we've been reading the same books too long, because that's never what a measurement meant in the real world. A measurement meant what I told you. It meant you look at a dial and you see where it goes. And there is some uncertainty to that, and therefore you average. That's what every measurement in the real world is like. So the people who think that doesn't count as a measurement, and that everything we do in the real world is some poor approximation to the beautiful theory we have in our textbooks, has physics backwards. The textbooks are an approximation to what we have in the real world. What we have in the real world looks something like that. All right, it might be digital, but it looks something like that. So back to Marlin, actually. One of the examples that we've studied where I think it's interesting to look at what weak measurement tells us is the question of the Bohr-Einstein debates. What happens if you do measure which of two paths a particle took on its way to a screen where there was interference? In particular, do you understand the disappearance of interference due to complementarity, the fact that you can't have particle-like and wave-like information? Do you understand it the way all of those problems are actually mathematically resolved by looking at the uncertainty principle, the momentum kick that you give the particles? Yakio will immediately tell us, you understand it by thinking about modular momentum. I understand that. It's the only right way to approach it. But if we ask the question about the momentum kick, it's interesting that different groups came up with different answers. In this particular example, Marlin and his coworkers proved that you could obtain which path information in a setting where you're not disturbing the momentum of the, in this case, atom beam at all. Whereas Dan Walz's group argued that you are always disturbing the momentum, and there are several other papers about that. But the question came down in part to what the definition of a momentum disturbance was. Turns out if you defined momentum disturbance one way, you could rigorously prove that all of the moments of the momentum transfer vanished. That might sound familiar to those of you who were paying attention to Yakio a moment ago. If you asked a different question about momentum transfer, defined it slightly differently, you could prove that it had to have support over a region larger than H bar over the slit separation. Howard Wiseman pointed out that you could study this using weak values, directly measure the momentum transfer. And that's what we did experimentally here. Experiment's a little noisy, so this is theory to compare. You see they actually agree qualitatively quite well. The fascinating thing is you immediately see these dashed lines show H over D, that there is support outside those regions, agreeing with Dan Walz's camp. What you can't immediately see, but you calculate, is that all of the moments of this distribution do in fact vanish. So it also agrees with Marlin's calculation. Now, the only reason those two things can be reconciled is because this is not a well-behaved function. This is basically a sinc function. It's not properly normalizable. So all of its moments vanish, even though it is not a delta function. The surprising thing to me, though, is the following. I was talking about two different theoretical calculations about two different quantities. And in this paper, we got very excited that we could measure a third quantity and satisfy the two theorems about those other two quantities. To me, this is a hint that everyone is actually barking up the right tree, that we define different things trying to get at the meaning of what the momentum transfer is. And if those different definitions are agreeing, maybe they're telling us something about how we really should be thinking about the momentum transfer. So that's not a final statement about, you know, what is the momentum transfer, what is reality, but it's a hint that these operational kinds of measurements are actually describing a quantity that should be of interest in the real world. All right, so those were just some hints about the past. More recently, there was work about Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, or rather, not the uncertainty principle, about variances, as shown there, but how much disturbance you must induce on a system when you make a measurement of a given precision. And for a long time, most people, although not everyone, believed that the same H bar over 2 limit applied. Ozawa, a little over a decade ago, demonstrated that that's not true. There is this sort of delta x, delta p on the left-hand side, but there are additional terms. And I'll just focus on this one. This isn't the strictest inequality that's been found since then. In any case, it turns out if there is already a large uncertainty in momentum, that can already satisfy this inequality without requiring you to disturb the momentum when you make your position measurement. One simple way of seeing that is if you have a very well-localized wave function, already has a huge uncertainty in momentum, and you just confirm that it's well-localized, you verify that it is indeed in this region you already knew it was in, you have no need to disturb the wave function at all. You make a measurement of finite precision, and instead of adding disturbance, you rely on the uncertainty that was already present. Well, how would you measure that? There are different answers, but in some sense, the most natural is measure the momentum before you do this von Neumann measurement, measure it again afterwards, see how much it changed by. But of course, to really do that without changing the position state over here, you need to do weak measurements. So the reason we were able to carry out this experiment was due to the proposal by London Wiseman of using weak values. We published this in 2012 at the same time as the Hasegawa group published a different version of the same, or actually, we published it a little bit later. All right, that was all motivational background. I hope I haven't put the experts among you, or the non-experts among you, if there are, to sleep. Now I want to tell you about the experiment we're actually quite proud of in our lab the last few years. We've been trying to observe the nonlinear effect of a single photon. For the non-optics people, What does that mean? It means we want to do quantum nonlinear optics. We want one photon to affect another photon. This could famously be a route to optical quantum computation. I'd say more generally, it merges the two fields of optics which have been of interest to physicists for the past half century, the field of nonlinear optics and the field of quantum optics, which used to be opposite sides of the world. If you could get strong enough nonlinearities, you would open up a whole new regime, as well as making optical quantum computers possible. There was an interesting proposal, again, about a decade ago, that suggested that you need what they call weak nonlinearities, which I think means only a million times stronger than what we knew how to do in the lab at the time, instead of a billion times stronger than what we knew how to do in the lab at the time, and use those to connect different qubits. And the basic idea is that each individual photon could interact not with another single photon, but maybe with a beam of 1,000 or 1,000,000 photons, as long as it wrote a measurable phase shift on that other beam. And that beam could then act as a kind of communication bus to indirectly couple multiple qubits. So that's the background that we have in mind. There are other schemes now that make much larger phase shifts. But the basic experiment amounts to this. There's some medium that we call a cross-phase modulation, or Kerr medium, that should allow the passage of a single signal photon, I start to have trouble with those two words, to shift the phase of a beam in an interferometer, a beam we'll call the probe. So that by closing this interferometer, measuring the phase shift on the probe, we can tell whether or not there was a photon there. Or more generally, we can count photons there. How does this work in optics, this cross-phase modulation? The easiest way to understand it is to think about a probe beam on some two-level transition. It experiences a refractive index that goes through a large change near resonance. But if there's an additional transition over here, and we send some pulse, perhaps a single photon, near resonance with that transition, its mere presence shifts those energy levels, something known as the AC Stark shift, which means the probe now finds itself off resonance. And when it finds itself off resonance, it finds its index of refraction has been modified, and as it propagates, it finds a new phase shift. So that AC Stark shift changes the effective detuning, which changes the index of refraction, giving us the nonlinear phase shift. I won't go into the optical details. We do something a little more complicated based on what's known as electromagnetically induced transparency. It gives us a sharper dependence of the phase shift on detuning, allows us to make this much more sensitive. But the bottom line is that that shift is always proportional to the intensity, and therefore the phase shift on the probe acts as a kind of measurement of the photon number. This is what our experiment looks like. We trap and cool a cloud of rubidium-85 atoms to a few microkelvin. There needs to be a kind of catalyst beam here, this thing I call the EIT coupling beam. And then with matched telescopes, we focus a signal pulse and a probe pulse through the center of that atom cloud. We then take the probe pulse and measure its phase here. We do that through a kind of frequency domain interferometry. Most of you don't care about the details. But as we change the average photon number in the signal pulse, what we see is that the phase shift on the probe depends linearly on this. If we get above 10 or 100,000 photons, we actually begin to saturate the atom and this falls off. But we were able to get down to pulses with, on average, one photon per pulse. And for the first time in a free space experiment, measure the nonlinear effect of such pulses on our probe beam. What we really wanted to do is do this with a true single photon. So we have a source of heralded single photons locked to the rubidium transition. And unfortunately, at the time, it was a little too weak, given the small value of this phase shift, for us to feasibly do that experiment. So we thought of something that was a backup plan for us, but in the end, I think much more interesting at a fundamental level. We began looking at pulses with, on average, five photons, of course, in a Poisson distribution, right, coherent state pulses. And we saw with two photons, we still saw it. We were about to go down to one photon when I said, why one photon? Why stop there? What happens if you send in a pulse with half a photon? Well, there is no such thing as half a photon. We all know that, right? That means, roughly speaking, there's a 50% chance of no photon and a 50% chance of one photon. Never mind that. That's just to check systematics. But after this pulse goes through the material, which is basically transparent, we can place a detector here, and we can see if the detector fires, there must have been a photon. If the detector doesn't fire, you might conclude there wasn't a photon. There are some details because the efficiency isn't perfect, but that's the rough idea. And therefore, we can separate out those two events. That's what I've shown here in red and blue. If the detector does not fire, and we look at the phase measurement, we get roughly zero. If the detector does fire and we look at it, we get roughly 15 microradians of phase shift. So there what we're seeing is the phase shift due not to an average number of one photon, but really due to this photon that caused the detector to fire. We can think about that a little more carefully. And this is classical statistics here, although my students insisted on doing the full quantum mechanical calculation. It took them a week to confirm what I told them, which is that it's the same calculation, just with extra math for no good reason. If you begin with a pulse with some average incident photon number, which just means you have a Poisson distribution, and you have a detector with some finite efficiency, then what you find is you get extra information from whether the detector registers no click or one click or two or three or four clicks if it's capable of doing that. And the interesting thing, if you just compare this sort of orangish, salmonish line to this blue one, is that every time the detector goes click, you should increase your best estimate of the number of photons present by one. All right? In the absence of background and these multiple clicks, that's an exact statement. Otherwise, there are these small corrections. As you see over here, it curves over due to background. Why exactly one? It turns out that's very easy to understand. We have a coherent state impinging on a beam splitter. After it goes through, this is the way quantum optics people like to model inefficient detectors. An inefficient detector is equivalent to a beam splitter that transmits some fraction eta of the light and sends it to a 100% efficient detector and rejects 1 minus eta of the light. So let's imagine our beam splitter that way. 1 minus eta is being lost here. Eta is being transmitted. The important thing is that for coherent states, the beam splitter generates a product state of the electromagnetic field in those two ports. What does a product state mean practically? It means that nothing you measure about one part of the system gives you any new information about the other. You already knew exactly what state the other part was in. So I make a measurement over here. This detector either goes click or it doesn't. That cannot have any effect on what's in this rejected port. Therefore, if you ask me to estimate the total number of photons, well, I have 1 minus eta times alpha squared coming out here. And over here, I measure either 0 or 1. Therefore, the total number of photons I should conclude was present is 1 minus eta times alpha squared, either plus 1 or not plus 1. That's the end of the story. It doesn't matter how big alpha was originally, as long as we're in this regime. So that's what we found. For every incident coherent state, we separated out the click and the no-click events. And no matter how many photons were coming in, we found there was an extra phase shift of this 13 or 15 microradians every time the detector fired. It's as though we were seeing the phase shift due to the photon which caused the detector to go click. All right? So that was how we observed the phase shift due to a single photon. Again, tests for systematics. Most of you don't care. But now I want to show you that a photon in the hand is worth 1,000 in the vacuum chamber, base 2. So most of you know this paper. This is what started the weak measurement industry. How the result of a measurement of a component of the spin of a spin 1/2 particle can turn out to be 100. In this formula I've shown you a few times and that you all already know, if the denominator, the overlap between initial and final states, is very small, then this thing may blow up. And this can have values that are as large as you like. They don't need to lie anywhere within the eigenvalue spectrum of this operator. All right, so that's why even if you measure S sub z on an electron, you could in principle find 100. And I'll just say in passing, this is something that may or may not be useful. This tendency to create a very large shift, even for weak couplings, has been applied in measurements of all sorts of different things, and we'll probably talk more about it this week. I may say a few words. But if you think about a photon in an interferometer, it has two different paths it can be in. It is therefore equivalent to a spin 1/2 system, as is any two-state system. So if we take our single photon, and we split it into two paths A and B and only let one of those paths go through the interaction region, our probe is now measuring N sub B, the occupation number of the mode in arm B. And if it measures that weakly, that's sort of equivalent to measuring the spin component of this two-level system. We can prepare the system in a given state, let's just say A minus B over root 2. We can post-select it in a nearly orthogonal state to make that denominator very small. So RA plus TB, where R and T are nearly 1 over root 2, but not exactly, so that the post-selection does succeed. And it's one line to work out that if this detuning from 50-50 is delta, the weak value of the photon number in arm B goes as 1 over 2 delta. even if you send one photon through this apparatus, if you try to measure what is the number of photons in arm B, you measure it weakly, you could get an arbitrarily large result, like the 100 for that spin. Well, you must measure it weakly, and that's good for us, because all we could do with our system is to measure things weakly. We only had 15 microradians to play with. So we decided to go ahead and do that. I already said all that. So here's the new version of our interferometer. It's a little more complicated now, because we now need an interferometer for the signal as well as an interferometer for the probe. The one for the probe I already hid before, and I'll keep hiding it. And the one for the signal, we play a little trick. Turns out that if the probe is sigma plus polarized, in our level scheme, it is far more sensitive to sigma plus photons than to sigma minus photons. So we can prepare a photon in a superposition of right-hand circular and left-hand circular, so just some linear polarization, knowing that essentially only the right-hand circular stuff is causing a phase shift. And the other polarization, left-hand circular, is like the arm that's not interacting with the photons. So we send in a horizontally polarized photon, and we make a measurement that's essentially counting how many of those photons are right-hand circular polarized. And if we post-select on the right linear polarization, not quite orthogonal to horizontal, but almost, we find that we get a value that's much greater than the single photon phase shift. Over here is our measurement in this setting of the single photon differential phase shift. And as we change delta and go closer and closer to that orthogonal beam splitter, we see that we get as large as 8 single photon phase shifts per photon. I should be a little honest. You'll remember that we're looking at the difference between click and no-click events. That hasn't changed. So this amplification shows up in the difference. It's the photon, again, I dare to say, that causes the detector to fire, which is being amplified. All the other photons that may be in that coherent state, they just cancel out, because it makes no difference whether the detector goes click or not. It's only the one that's being post-selected that gets amplified here. All right? So unlike most weak value experiments, which use different properties of the same optical beam and could therefore be understood perfectly well using Maxwell's equations, this relies on true entanglement between two different optical beams, our signal beam and our probe beam. So it's the first fully quantum deterministic optical weak value amplification experiment. Some of you know why there are so many qualifiers. But I do now want to ask whether there's any practical use. Liz, maybe you can give me an idea how much time I have left, though.
So you should finish at 49 minutes past about 5 minutes.
Oh, I can do much better than that. So as I said, there have been attempts to make use of weak value amplification to enhance signals of small effects. So in the case of our experiment, we have this very small phase shift, this thing on the order of 13 microradians. That's actually hundreds of times smaller than the quantum uncertainty on our probe right now. That means we can't do a single shot measurement. We're not doing true quantum non-demolition yet, right? We're pushing towards that, but there are severe challenges. Suppose, however, that one's goal was to measure the strength of this nonlinear effect. Very small thing. How do you measure it with one photon? Well, the idea is that if you set up a situation where the weak value of photon number is 8 or 100 or 1,000, you get a much larger phase shift on the probe, and it becomes much easier to measure. All right, so that's what Hostin and Quiot used to do the first measurement of the spin Hall effect for light. And John Howell's group and Andrew Jordan's did a lot of work really looking at the signal-to-noise issues here, demonstrating that they could measure beam deflection using weak values in sort of classical-like interferometers. For those of you who aren't familiar with this work, I can never put this abstract up without pointing out this number over here. When this first came out, someone asked me to comment on it, and I kept staring at this 400 plus or minus 200 femtoradians and asking myself if anyone knew what a femtoradian was. And I finally worked out the answer, which was if I had really, really steady hands, and I pointed this laser pointer at the moon. Don't look at the ceiling. I pointed at the moon. And I shook by 200 femtoradians. The spot on the moon would shake around by the width of a human hair. That's the kind of precision that we're talking about here. Absolutely inconceivable. However, it's one thing to say I did a really good measurement. It's much harder to prove And I did it much better than you would have been able to without using my favorite technique. So that's what this field has devolved into a little bit, really trying to figure out where the limits are. And that's awfully controversial, as many people here know. Weak value amplification is suboptimal for estimation and detection. In fact, flipping a coin and getting 100 heads is completely classical, depending on whose head it is.
Especially if it's an idiot's.
All right. On the other hand, anomalous weak values are non-classical in a very precise sense. And I think my favorite riposte was due to Lev, who points out that all of this discussion only follows from a complete misunderstanding of the concept of weak value. This argument has continued. I haven't updated except with a recent paper showing that even though there is no advantage, we can experimentally quantify what the advantage is. So argument does continue. Let me give you the short version for those of you who haven't been part of this controversy. The weak value goes as 1 over this overlap. So if I make the overlap small, I get a big value. The problem is I have to do post-selection, and the post-selection probability is the square of the overlap. So if I make the pointer shift 10 times bigger, I've got to turn my data rate down by a factor of 100. So I don't know how many of you remember your undergraduate lab courses or have had to teach them, but that's the first thing we tell people, right? Root n. If you have 100 times more data, your measurement is 10 times better. 100 times less data, you lose all the advantage due to that. It's a total wash. So this was what first convinced me not to bother with weak value amplification. I wish I had thought ahead a little bit. The counterargument is that assumes something about the noise. And the words that we usually use without definition are statistical and technical, which just means if this is true, we'll call it statistical, and we'll imagine there might be something else where it's not true, and we'll call that technical. All right, as far as I can tell, that's the definition. Andrew's looking annoyed at me. So there were early conjectures that we can argue about later because I disagree with them. But there are cases where I think this really is valid. And the idea is that the reason our noise, or our uncertainty, I should say, drops as 1 over root n is because it's a kind of random walk. Every time you take a new data point, you're looking at an uncorrelated value of the noise field. And the more you add of those, the lower your standard deviation of the mean gets. However, in real life, noise is often correlated. It's often some slow fluctuation. Maybe you have 60 hertz noise. Maybe you have 1 over F noise that has a lot of slow components. Taking more data points within a noise correlation time means you keep measuring the same value of the noise field. Well, nothing is going to average away if you keep measuring the same value of the noise field. All right? So adding those data points does not help you, and you don't get anything better. On the other hand, if you throw some of them away in this way, you can make your pointer shift larger without losing any of the advantage that comes from the normal root n. All right, so that's the argument about how this might work. There are a few other trivial examples. If you're limited by detector saturation, normally what you do is you attenuate your laser beam. Well, why just attenuate your laser beam if you know you could do a post-selection and also gain something in return? I think that one's kind of obvious. There are questions about whether you have weak coherent states where many of your bins don't even have a photon. Why average those in when you can instead just throw them out? But I think the interesting one is this noise correlation one. And we've been doing some more work on it, more slowly than I would have wished, but I apologize for that. And essentially, this is what we find. As you turn up the photon rate, in other words, the number of photons coming in within a correlation time, you would find that your, I call it signal-to-noise ratio, if you prefer, it's 1 over the Fisher information, grows until you hit 1 photon per correlation time. And then if you just blindly average, it basically saturates. If you do weak value amplification, it continues to grow until you end up with 1 post-selected photon per correlation time. And the Ferry and Coombs argument is also correct. There is a different kind of post-selection you could do, different kind of post-processing, that's even a little bit better than just continuing this straight line. Once there are correlations in the noise, you can make extra use of those and do a little bit better over here. It's essentially a kind of background subtraction. It's what experimentalists would think of as lock-in amplification. So what we found is that weak value amplification actually is great. Lock-in amplification, which we all love, is even a little bit better. And the question is, are there cases where it's easier to do this than that because they're almost the same? I don't yet know the answer to that, except some of these classical-like situations. I will say that in our weak value amplification paper, just amplifying that single photon, we found a surprise. We planned to move ahead and really look at the signal to noise with different kinds of noise spectra. But so far, we just wanted to demonstrate the amplification. And only when my student was analyzing the data did he find that he used about 800 million trials, which meant about 200 million successful post-selections. And he found a cross-phase shift that had a 0.6 microradian uncertainty. That's a lot of femtoradians, but you'll excuse us. This was one photon at a time. And then he said, wait a second, let me look at our old paper. In the old paper, we used more photons. We used 1 billion trials, and we got 300 million events. And yet we had a 4 microradian uncertainty. So in fact, our ability to measure this differential phase shift was almost 10 times better in this new experiment, even though that's not even what we were looking for. We weren't adding any slow noise or anything like that. And it turns out there's a little bit of a cheat here. Remember that this is a very strange measurement we're doing, where we're looking at a differential between when something goes click and when it doesn't, because that's the way we learn something about that particular photon. So we're using things with an uncertain number of photons, but we want to measure what happens for individual photons. And that gives us the funny situation where when we make a very unlikely post-selection, you know what we do? We just turn up the intensity of the laser. So if our post-selection only has a 5% success rate, we make sure that we send in more than 20 photons so that a lot of times a photon comes out at the end. So you could call that a cheat. Depends on how you count the resources. If you look at how precise our measurement is versus the number of photons we sent in, you'll say, oh, of course you did better. You sent in a lot more photons. That's fair. But if the resource that matters to you is how many pulses did you have or how many times did you allow your detector to go click, well, no, in that case, we had fewer of those clicks and still got a better measurement. So it's maybe somehow related to my earlier argument about saturation, but a little bit different in this case. Anyway, it's just an example to show that there is reason to think that there are situations where there are advantages to this. Here was an unanticipated one, literally unanticipated. So it's worth considering what other cases you can use weak value for. So let's see, I have 3 more minutes, so I'll tell you about the future. I've been fascinated ever since my PhD with the question of tunneling times. This was a sketch due to Scientific American about how long Heisenberg takes to tunnel through a wall. And the question is, when Heisenberg looks at the white rabbit's watch after he gets through, what does he see? The question of how long a particle spends within a forbidden region has been controversial since roughly 1932. People from Wigner on through Boudicca have argued about it for a long time. And I think one of the most interesting ways to address it is this thing known as the Larmor clock, which is to say, let us let a tunneling particle carry a clock with it while it's going through the forbidden region. Let us imagine, for instance, that the particle has a spin, which precesses while in a magnetic field, and that there's a magnetic field confined to the barrier region. According to Bass and Rybachenko, we could just look at the precession of the spin after it gets through, figure out what is this angle divided by the known Larmor frequency, and calculate a time. Boudicca realized it was more complicated because, in fact, the primary effect of that magnetic field is to cause a preferential transmission of the aligned particles rather than the anti-aligned particles. So although there's a small precession angle, there's a much larger alignment angle. And he wasn't initially entirely sure what to do with those two different angles, so he added them in quadrature and said this is the right answer. It was interesting that mathematically, they're equivalent to what you get from a different technique that just follows Feynman paths and does an averaging, which a lot of people had objected to because after you do that averaging, you get a complex number. However, it turns out that this precession angle, the thing that Bass and Rybachenko would have liked, is the real part of that complex time, and this alignment angle is the imaginary part. You can think of these as weak values. This spin is a pointer with a huge uncertainty. It's supposed to precess. However, the weak value of a tunneling particle's dwell in this region has an imaginary part, which represents back action of the measurement. And that is this alignment. That is why they're real and imaginary parts. No one understood that at the time, because this was happening before the papers on weak values. But now we can actually imagine measuring them. And we can even imagine measuring them locally, putting that magnetic field in different regions of the barrier and asking how long did the particle spend at any given point in the barrier. And here's the result of a calculation of mine, redone better by one of my students. But there are two different calculations. the barrier goes from minus 1 micron to 1 micron, and we ask how much time in milliseconds per micron does the particle spend in each region, we can now post-select because we've done a weak measurement. We can look only at the transmitted particles or only at the reflected particles. And this is what I think is exciting about weak measurements. We get different answers. So it is no longer true that the prepared wave function is all you can say about the state of the system. This is showing the importance of the two-state formalism. It's showing that there is a different history for the transmitted and the reflected particles. Shockingly, none of them spend very much time in the middle of the barrier at all. There's this exponential decay from one side or both sides. That's one of the confusing things about tunneling. But to me, equally interesting is that the transmitted particles spend the same amount of time at the entrance and at the exit. After all, I know I sent it in here, but I also know I found it coming out there. By time symmetry, shouldn't those both see just as much of the particle? Whereas the reflected particles only ever see the entrance. They never get to the exit. So this is the kind of thing we want to test experimentally, and the kind of question that, frankly, doesn't make a lot of sense before you have weak measurements. All right? I mean, it came out of these Larmor times, but the Larmor time people just didn't realize that they were anticipating weak measurement. That's exactly what they were talking about. So you can even make a movie as a function of time of where the particle is spending. It's like these movies of psi squared versus time, except this is a conditional psi squared. And you see that although it begins in a wave packet on the left, if I condition on finding it on the right, that is where I will find it. And this is how it's predicted to evolve. You notice that it spends almost no time in the middle of the barrier. Well, after decades of talking about this, we actually now have atoms trapped above narrow sheets of light through which they can tunnel. This is what we call a rest trap. The atoms are sitting on a table made of light. The table has edges, so you see them spilling off. But then through the middle, you see atoms that can either leak over or tunnel through the barrier. And we've recently published our first paper describing that. This is the geometry and lots of pretty false color and 3D. Study the nonlinear tunneling of the atoms through this barrier. That's the data of this nonlinear tunneling affected by the mean field of the trapped atoms. But more interestingly, we've begun to implement that Larmor clock. We haven't yet been able to combine the Larmor clock with the tunneling. We just did it in free space by doing a kind of effective Larmor rotation. And what you see here is that if you map the dwell time in this probe beam versus the initial velocity of the atoms, it goes as 1 over the initial velocity. So to my knowledge, this is one of the highest tech demonstrations that T is L divided by V. I'm sure it's not the highest tech demonstration. Anyway, let me just leave you with that and say that my conviction is that if there is some deeper understanding we can get of quantum mechanics, it seems clear that these questions you can pose with weak measurements are going to tell us something about that. And we've already seen that even a single photon can have an effect much larger than the effect of one individual photon if you post-select it properly. Thank you for your attention.
Minutes for questions.
I love your talk, but I want to go back about 15 view graphs where you talked about weak measurements as really being part and parcel of phase lock detection. Okay, you with me? Give me that.
Is that what I said? Phase lock detection.
Yeah, so I was, you made the observation that phase lock detection is really.
I see what you're talking about. Yeah, sorry.
The reason I'm excited about this is I've been claiming that to my colleagues at lunch for a long time.
Oh.
And they've all been saying, no, it's crazy. And I'll tell you why they say that. But
all
I think you're right. Okay, better known as lock-in technique. Can you say some more about that? Have you published something on that?
We're getting very close to publishing something on that, but we have not yet. The idea is that what you're doing in weak value amplification is, in addition to measuring the thing you want, you do some subsequent measurement on the system, and you do some correlation between the two. It may involve throwing stuff out. It doesn't need to. And what Ferry and Coombe showed is you shouldn't throw stuff out. I think we all knew that. It's better to keep it than to throw it out. What's important is you do the subsequent measurement. It actually doesn't matter whether it's subsequent. You could replace measuring afterwards whether there's one photon or zero with having a chopper at the input and sending in one photon some of the time and zero some of the time. If you had that control, that's what you would do. That's how every experimentalist measures small things, because then instead of looking at the overall data stream that comes out with all this noise, you keep chopping between 1, 0, 1, 0, 1, 0, and you subtract the two every time. And as long as the noise is varying more slowly than that, you cancel out all of the noise. So it turns out for that kind of regime, slow noise, that is the best thing that you can do. However, this other approach by weak value amplification, which involves fewer detections, does almost as well.
Because if you don't go quick, I will.
We're doing it relatively quick now.
Is there a last question from Andrew?
I love this as the second talk in foundational questions, having such a practical talk. And you quite rightly put your finger on the fact that it depends how you count resources when you're talking about advantages and measurement techniques. What are the constraints, or under what constraints on resources would your single photon measurement have an advantage over just making measurements with the kind of photons today?
I would say in this case there's more of a philosophical difference. The first measurement we did is calibration dependent. We get a linear dependence on intensity, and I tell you, trust me, this corresponds to one photon. When we do it with the click, we see directly, fundamentally, what is the effect of one quantum of light without having to trust that. So in that sense, if you want to do that measurement, it's the only way to do it. And if you're doing it that way, there's an advantage.
Yeah.
Turns out our calibration wasn't that bad. So you might argue you don't need to do that anymore. However, then there's the issue of looking at the difference between the sigma plus and the sigma minus.
Yeah.
But honestly, we're still in a regime where if all you wanted to know is the atomic interaction parameters, turning up the intensity to at least a few hundred photons, doing it classically, would still be better.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks.
All right. So thanks.